Hello, hello, hello. Hello, Georgians, hello, global citizens, and hello, concerned Americans. My name is Varun Kadathala, and I'm the current co-host of the Politician Podcast, which myself and my high school best friend Damian Galvin created in June of this year to talk about issues that interest us, issues that disgust us, and issues that America needs to know about. In other words, myself and Damian created this podcast to deconstruct public policy issues of the past and the present and create a more equitable future for all of us. We have a very, very special episode queued up for you guys, but before we play this episode, we're going to give a special thank you to our sponsor, Patreon, and our wonderful team here at Politician, which includes high school juniors Jada Pilling, Yi Shen, and Julia Hartman. Thank you guys so much for listening to this episode, and we hope that you enjoy. See you in the episode.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Politician. My name is Damian Galvin, and as always, I am joined by my wonderful co-host, Varun.
Hello, everybody. Once again, my name is Varun Kadathala. I'm the co-host of the Politician Podcast today. Here with another very special guest on our podcast, as we always have. Today, it's Senator Nikema Williams, the Georgia State Senator for District 39, and currently set poised to take a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives this year. Now, to explain about herself, talk about herself more in detail, we have Nikema Williams herself here. So, Nikema, if you want to introduce yourself to any of our viewers and listeners today, that'd be perfect for us.
Hello, everybody. I am State Senator Nikema Williams, and I have the honor of being the Democratic nominee for Georgia's 5th Congressional District, where I'm excited to go to Congress and be the voice of the people in the greater Atlanta metropolitan area, fighting for all things that are right and just, and making sure that we are truly living up to the promise of America for all of us. I also have the privilege of being the first Black woman to chair our state Democratic Party, where we have made great strides, and we are battleground Georgia.
Yeah, I'm excited. I think Georgia's been making an insane change over the last 20 years. I think we've become more diverse. When it comes to, you know, we've always had a strong African-American community in the state of Georgia, but now we're seeing even a more diverse community within that community itself. And, you know, you're having more Hispanics move in and more Asian Americans come in. But before that, I wanted to ask you, what drove you to get into politics?
So I've kind of always been just curious and wanting to find, like, I've always been the person who spoke up for other people. My husband often calls me the Lorax. He's like, if somebody needs speaking for, Nikema is going to speak for them. And I grew up not realizing that I was doing something in a political realm, but I grew up in rural Alabama and raised by my grandparents and my grandpa and his brother, my Uncle Willie James. They had these slate cards. And so I just thought it was fun that I got to hop off and on of the back of my grandpa's pickup truck, but I got to pass out slate cards to our neighbors so that they knew exactly who to vote for. Spoiler alert, they raised me to be a Democrat, and it was only the Democrats on the slate card with the boxes checked. So that kind of, that was kind of my foundation, and also just knowing how politics and elected officials decide everything that we're able to do in this country, whether we want to be political or not, especially as a Black woman, my entire existence and identity is political. And my great aunt integrated the University of Alabama, so she was the first Black student ever admitted to the University of Alabama, and so that was also like a huge part of like just grounding me in who I am. I remember in 9th grade reading about her in my Alabama history books, and I came home and I was like, Ma, Auntie Authorine is in my history book. And it, like, I knew like you've done something special, but I didn't realize the magnitude of it until I was in 9th grade. And so that kind of like pushed me to like want to dig more and find out more about what happened in like the history of the state in Alabama and like the people that were responsible for that and holding people that look like me back. And I had a high school teacher. He was also the SGA advisor. I was on SGA in high school, Mr. Cunningham. And he kind of just poured into me and allowed me to learn more and more. He was my civics and government teacher. But there was this trip that I was able to go to Washington, D.C., my first time on an airplane, my first time traveling without my family. And there were a group of us who went on a close-up trip with the Close-Up Foundation to Washington, D.C. to learn more about our government and to meet our member of Congress and to just have a better understanding of how our government works. and I kind of just got the bug and have not looked back. Even coming to after college, I went to Talladega College and I moved to Atlanta after college, and I didn't know anyone, but I knew I wanted to be more involved. I wanted to be engaged, and I joined my local Young Democrats chapter, and that was 18 years ago, and I have not looked back since. I've been involved in some leadership capacity or another at every level of the Democratic Party since 2002, and even now serving as the first Black woman to chair our party.
Absolutely. I mean, in terms of Young Democrats, I'm the co-chair of our high school Democrats chapter in my area. So that's something I definitely have some kind of connection to. But I believe that your inspiration is very unique with your family members and really what you've experienced in Washington. I do want to talk about something that I caught on to reading about you, researching about you before the podcast. And that's the fact that you've been in politics for a very long time, but you first ran for office in 2017. And I saw some quotes from you that said that, for example, you're a strong believer that people, if they're doing their job right, you don't have to replace them. And that's something that I believe in as well. So what inspired you in 2017 to actually run for office instead of just working with campaigns and political spheres to get Democrats elected? What inspired you to actually go out there and put your name on a ballot? What did that implicate?
Yeah, so I have been involved in Georgia politics for 15 years before I found myself actually on the ballot. In 2017, my state senator was running for mayor of Atlanta, and in Georgia, you know, we don't get a chance to like test the waters. You have to resign to run for a new seat. And my state senator was running for mayor, and I started hearing like all of the conversations around who was considering running. Right. And I knew that I could do a better job. I had worked at the Capitol for 10 years as the vice president of public policy for Planned Parenthood Southeast. So I'd been writing policy, helping to stop bad policies and advance solutions to support women and families of this state. And when the position came available, I had a 2-year-old son at the time living in Vine City in the Atlanta, downtown Atlanta area. And we were living in the shadows of a $1 billion stadium. And I looked around me and I recognized that there were so many children in that neighborhood who were never even gonna be able to step foot right into that stadium or have access to it. But yet taxpayer dollars were paying for it. And who was looking out for those children? I knew that my husband and I were gonna do everything possible to make sure that my son Carter had every opportunity in the world. But I wanted to make sure someone was also there for those other children living in my neighborhoods. And so I, after years of almost 2 decades of helping other people get elected to office, I decided to put my name in the hat. And there were 5 people running. There was a runoff in this election, and I led on both ballots. I led on the first ballot, but didn't get to 50%. And then in the runoff, right, I got over 50% and became the new member of the state Senate from Georgia's 39th district, which was also a very historic district. Thinking back just over the history of it, it's always been an activist-based district, a district that elects fighters. And just Julian Bunn held the Senate seat that I once held. And so knowing that someone who stood on his morals and convictions, who the Georgia General Assembly actually refused to seat because of his stance on the Vietnam War, really meant a lot to me. And so I knew going into that seat that I had to make sure that I was always centering those most marginalized in my decision-making and making sure that I was a voice for the people.
You know, something interesting, I was talking to Varun earlier today, we have our law class together, and something interesting that I was talking to him about is it's rare to talk to someone that has your dream job, particularly, you know, or in the setting that you're talking to them, you know, what's that like? Especially or particularly in the setting when it's like a lawyer or a doctor, you know, typically in those environments, you're talking to them with a legal problem or obviously, you know, a health checkup or something like that. And today, you know, when we figured out that we were going to have, you know, Senator Williams on the podcast, and you were going to go in and, you know, take the seat that John Lewis left behind, I thought it's crazy to think that someone or a position where there's only 434 other people that can say they have that same job is going to be talking to us today. Yeah. But I see that you have had that a similar experience with John Lewis endorsing you. In the research, you know, there was the fact that John Lewis endorsed you, and he if I'm not mistaken, he went right out. The second you know your name was on the ballot, he came out and endorsed you. And I just wanted to ask you, what does it mean to you? Because it's something so important today to have those good role models. And more so, I think that politicians are being looked at as role models. So what did that mean to you?
So, well, first, Damian, Varun, am I hearing that we have some future members of Congress with us today? Is that what I'm hearing?
I mean,
that's in the dream.
Yeah, that's the dream.
That's the dream.
So, well, I will say one of the best lessons that I was ever given was make your friends before you need them. So hold on to these relationships and the friendships you're building right now, because yeah, they will become all the more critical when you decide to put your name on that ballot. But as far as Congressman Lewis, when I was running for state senate is when he endorsed me. And running for, I remember the day that I was sworn in, and I did not know that he was going to be attending my swearing in on in December of 2017 down at the state capitol. And I remember standing there and looking up and seeing him sitting on the front row. And it gave me so much a sense of belonging, like I knew that I was supposed to be there, and that he was so encouraged and so happy that I was successful in my race. He had endorsed me early on, and when I announced for state senate, and made sure that he came out strong in support of me, hosting my very first fundraiser and showing up that day at the Capitol to see me get sworn in. He literally left the Atlanta airport, came down to the Capitol, watched me get sworn in. Wow. Was not even able to stay. Like, we had a little celebration afterwards, but he was headed right back to the airport because he wasn't supposed to be in Atlanta. So I do not take it lightly that I have the privilege and the honor of serving in the seat that he held for 34 years. I understand the magnitude of this moment. I understand the work that was left to be done. I understand the legacy that he's paved and the legacy that he left for me to build upon. And I don't take that lightly as I go to Congress in January to be the voice of the people of the 5th Congressional District.
Right, absolutely. And speaking of midnight dreams, these kinds of dreams for Americans, John Lewis was a role model for a lot of people. He was that giant that we all saw him to be. And you can, I think that if you ascend to Congress, you know, believing that you do, you will become that kind of person as a Black African-American woman in our district, in our area. You're an inspiration to many people. So kudos to you on that front. But in terms of historic and talking about historic elections, historic campaigns for Congress, you began your campaign, if I'm not mistaken, on the day the Voting Rights Act was signed. Am I right?
Yes, August 6th, the anniversary of the signing of the Voting Rights Act.
Right. And so I was doing some digging into that, and I figured out that Governor Kemp, and I knew this for a very long time, but Governor Kemp has been doing a lot to suppress voters, especially from minorities in our area, in our state. More specifically, one of the things that caught my eye, Nicandle, was the fact that Governor Kemp is decreasing the number of polling locations, more specifically in areas that have minority majorities or African-American majorities, and also low-income areas. So what do you have to say about voter suppression over the past couple of terms for Governor Kemp, and how that's affected the elections, and also how that kind of affects the integrity of politics in our state? And what you're willing to do about it once you get to Washington.
Needless to say, Governor Kempen and I do not see eye to eye on this. We're not. I'm not the person that he's consulting with. Trying to force through voter suppressive tactics in our government, even to the point of after his election and the results in 2018, I was standing with my constituents down at the state capitol and I was arrested. Yeah. Standing with them demanding that every vote be counted. So it's safe to say we did not even start off on the right foot. So looking at just the, like what we've been through in the state from 2018, we're the poster child for what not to do when it came to an election. And then looking at even our 2019 elections, I mean, our 2020 elections here for our primaries, we saw across the country, they were highlighting what happened in Georgia for our June 9th primary. And that's not who we should be. We are in the Deep South. We were under the umbrella of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And there have been so many changes under Kemp's leadership. Number one, when he was Secretary of State, and then now as governor. And he's done nothing to make sure that everyone who wants to cast a vote, especially in the middle of a pandemic, can do so safely. We are seeing other states that are making it easier for people to cast their vote because we're in a global pandemic. But in Georgia, we want to still smear fear tactics and make sure that make people feel like they're going to be investigated for fraud if they vote by mail, or making it seem like there's a difference in vote by mail and absentee ballots because they want their people to still use them by calling it absentee ballots. But then when Democrats want to use the same system, they want to change it to vote by mail so that people think there's something wrong with it. It's the same thing. If you vote absentee ballot, you're mailing it in. That is vote by mail. So
go ahead.
Just thinking through all of the issues that we've dealt with, the long lines, the communities that we've seen the long lines in, some of our counties are getting it right. I saw that in Fulton County alone, there were 5 early voting locations for the June primary. And just yesterday it was announced that there's gonna be 30 for this November election.
Wow. So
increasing the capacity, having partners like State Farm Arena, the High Museum, the Georgia International Convention Center, partnering to make sure that these large, large venues are opening up their doors and being good stewards of the community and making sure that people have ample space to safely cast their votes if they want to do so in person. So we're seeing some changes on the local level. It's gonna take a little bit more on the state level and the national level. We've gotta get the right people in office, and I'm committed to that.
Right. And we saw Florida's absentee ballots last week. Both me and Damien, something to add, President Trump's face and campaign logos were all on there. And so it's confusing to see the difference between a single word that means the exact same thing. And really, in terms of politics today, integrity and trust and really being a good politician means two different things for each different party. And the definition of words has changed, and that's something that we can't ever get past. Just something to add from mine before Damien continues with our conversation here today.
Definitely. I think that, you know, speaking of integrity, I was I do some side work for Polititeen. You know, as a 16-year-old, it's especially now with the pandemic, it's hard to get a job or work. And I was doing some side work yesterday for a neighbor trying to, you know, get some money to put here into Polititeen and work hard to make this grow. And I see so many people doing that, so many people working hard right now. And, you know, I have always thought that that's the American spirit, and that's what it means to be American. But nonetheless, I was speaking to my neighbor, and you know, he was a Vietnam veteran. He showed me his library, and he showed me the medals that his father, him, and his son have won. And you know, it went to show just what it really does mean to kind of have that American fighting spirit. And I think that integrity is something that is being downplayed, I think, in politics. But I think more so than integrity, it's being empathetic. I think it's being understanding of your fellow citizens. And you know, he told me, and obviously we're talking here about local politics, but I'd love to hear your take on just kind of the whole climate of politics in general. But he told me, you know, the reason that he wanted to vote for Trump was because he didn't believe Biden was strong enough. And I sat there and I told him, I was like, in a sense, I agree with you. I don't know if Biden is physically as strong as Trump. Strong enough is another thing, but physically as strong, I said, I don't know. But one thing that Trump isn't is empathetic. And I think that right now we're a nation that needs that empathy, that needs that understanding, and that, you know, needs, I guess, a sense of reunification.
Yeah, I mean, just thinking through like the empathy of people's situations and being able to see yourselves in their situations. We all view life through our lived experiences, and that is from the people who agree with Trump and the fear that they have of the browning of America, the browning of the electorate, and what that means for their power and where the power that they've held in this country for so long. So change is hard for a lot of people. I for one don't get it. I don't understand it as a Black woman in this country, but just being able to understand the fear of change in so many people. And I tell people all the time that I can work, when people ask me about working across the aisles, I have to dig a little deeper to understand what they really mean by that, because I am willing to work with people. I'm willing to extend the olive branch, but who I'm not willing to work with are those people who don't even believe in my basic humanity as a person. And let's not make the mistake of thinking that those people aren't out there, and some of them are in leadership. And so the work that, like, working down at the state capitol, there are some Republicans who I can laugh with in the hallways. We can talk, we can, like, there are so many issues that we can work together on. And then those, there are some Republicans who won't even look me in the eye because I'm invisible to them and I should not even be in their space to them. And those are the people that I'm not willing to work with. And so when people talk about, like, partisan politics and how rough politics have gotten and the divisiveness, I think what it is we are, like, they are focusing on that part of it, because there are a lot of people that you can work with, and people might say that I am very partisan, but there's only one party right now that is standing up for me as a person, as a Black woman in this country, as a woman who is raising a little Black boy in this country, who is still, who I'm still fighting every day to make sure that he understands that him coming home alive is the floor and not the ceiling. We demanding that my Black husband and my Black son's life matters has become controversial for people. And when we get into that space, it's a problem. And so people can call it divisive or call it whatever they want, but I am going to stand up for my family's right to exist in this country. And so we have a long way to go to get people to that understanding, but times are changing. And I think we're getting there. I will never forget in debating the hate crimes bill in the Georgia legislative session just this past June. And one of my Republican colleagues who was younger, he stopped by my office just to talk one day. And he was like, Nikema, I just want you to know that I have lived in my bubble, and I, because this didn't exist in my world, I didn't get it until I saw everything that happened around the Ahmaud Arbery case. I saw what happened with George Floyd, and he said, I get it. Racism is real and it's systemic, and we've got to do something about it. And this was a white Republican that I served with in the Georgia State Senate. And he went to the well and gave a heartfelt speech on why he was voting for the hate crimes legislation and why that was just the start and not the ending. And those are the people that I'm willing to work with. We don't have to agree on everything. He's a Republican and I'm a Democrat. So there are a whole lot of things that we are never gonna agree on. But agreeing on my basic humanity as a person is where we should all have a common basis.
Yeah, and I have to agree with you 1,000%. And in being a minority, it's difficult saying these things. I think it's difficult not being a minority, but I can never understand the people that just can't see the problem. And I think I've mentioned this on the podcast, and I'd love to hear your opinion on it. But you know, it's one thing that has always upset me is when you see the George Floyds and when you see the Ahmaud Arbery's and when you see the Breonna Taylor's. And you know, they're on the news. The first thing that they are, at least by, you know, from what I've seen on the right, is attacked, right? There's no condolences to the family. There's no, you know, we're sorry, we're going to try to change this. The first thing that comes out is always, well, it was fentanyl, and oh, he was trespassing, and oh, well, she was doing things that she wasn't supposed to do, or else there wouldn't have been a warrant. And that always gets under my skin. Because at the end of the day, we're all humans, and this shouldn't have happened to anyone. And I think the thing that at the end of the day just pushed me over, and I rarely ever get frustrated. I rarely ever get really upset with something. But when I saw the Kyle Rittenhouse situation and I saw how people were coming out to defend him, it got so much under my skin, because people wouldn't do that for George Floyd. On the contrary, they'd go out and attack him. And on the podcast, you know, we've even said before, you know, if Jesus was a Black man and he came down to earth and you know, he was, the police brutality was what, you know, killed him, people would still find a way to criticize him. And I can't believe that it's gotten to that point. And again, with politics, it's one of the few things that I will get actually, like, infuriated about. It's just, racism is something that I've just never been able to understand. But racism, when you're talking about someone that is dead, is just so beyond that limit.
Yeah, it's like they automatically find, they're looking for a way to excuse what happened to them, because of course there had to be something wrong with them from the beginning. instead of looking at, well, this person is dead or this person has been brutally attacked or whatever right. is happening at the moment.
It's almost like you can predict sometimes, Dakema, what each side is going to say about an instance based upon what happens. Because you can almost predict if the person's black, Republicans are going to say there was something already happening with him. There was fentanyl in the system, things like that. And if the person is white, Republicans are going to say something along the lines of, for example, with Kyle Rittenhouse, he was 17. He could have it could have been a simple mistake. He can make mistakes as a kid. I think that it's very easy to predict sides during this election. And I think that when you're talking about, you know, having people who sit in your shoes and understand yourself and your sides, there are some people that can kind of, as you said, change sides and understand the real issues with our nation. Even after a while, I'm supporting the adverse side. You can't ever lose your belief in the American people, in humans, towards their ability towards changing. I think that we always have to strive for that. And that's what our podcast does. We try to change people's perceptions if they are divisive or discriminatory in that sense. And we also try to give people perspective from which they can make their own decisions to agree with us or to not agree with us. It's more about perspective for us. But I think that in terms of hate, I mean, the Indian American community has gotten not nearly as much hate as other minorities in our nation, simply because, first of all, we come from India, having these H-1B1 specialized skill visas. We're already here, pretty skilled and rich, I believe. But I think that what I've seen the most in terms of discrimination against my community has been immigration reform. And a lot of my friends and my peers have been deported based upon the simple idea that Indian Americans and H-1B1 visas they shouldn't be put out for everybody to have. So I think I want to ask you about how we can really move towards immigration reform, because I've been doing some research and all the reform ideas that have been put out either prioritize a certain minority over another minority or just aren't comprehensive enough from the Republican side of things. So in Congress, do you think that there's any reforms that we can implement to kind of prevent people from being deported? Because I have a lot of friends, peers, cousins, relatives come out and say, Varun, I don't know what's going on in my nation. And I'm running the risk of getting deported from the country that I love and I've been a part of for so long.
I mean, and it's sad. And I think about especially what we're seeing here in Georgia with one of the worst ICE detention centers in the country down in Irwin County. And yeah. We've seen everything that is happening right now. And part of it is we have gotten to the point where your citizenship status has already, some segment of our population already deems you as less than. And that should not be the basis of how we operate in this country. We're hearing about people, ICE detainees down in Irwin, who have been forcibly sterilized, women who are going in for medical treatment and coming out with hysterectomies. Those are things that we saw happening during slavery. And I know for women of color all too well in this country, we know what it's like to be on the receiving end of a government that does not value you as a person. And until we can get to the point where we are valuing people as people and not based on what type of papers they have, what type of citizenship records, because that is what got us into this country. And actually, I guess we should not expect much more at this point until we get new leaders in place, because that's what our country is founded upon. If you look at the history of slavery in this country and having freed slaves and people and still enslaved people and having to carry around documentation to show that you're free, gave you one set of laws that applied to you and another set that didn't. What we are seeing right now play out before our eyes is the very same thing that we saw in the basis in the formation of our country. So we have to do a better job of making sure that we are vetting candidates when they're running for office. We have the perfect opportunity this November to get this right. Actually, not even this November, because right now voting is happening across the country. We absentee ballots have been mailed. And so it is critically important that even before we get to the details of a policy solution, like, do people at the core of who they are believe that regardless of citizenship status, we should all be treated equally? And for some people, that's just not the case. They don't believe that.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate. I think that the conversations that are being had towards immigration, there can be more conversations being had first off. Firsthand, I remember, and this is something that I carry, especially when someone tries to understand, because I think that there are some people really, you know, kind of like your Republican colleague that you had mentioned, that don't really understand until they get put into a different environment. And Ted Terry said the amazing quote that travel is the cure to ignorance in a lot of cases. And a lot of people have never left their bubble, especially here in the South, where that's more, you know, it's generational, generational racism oftentimes, and generational ideology that gets passed down.
Leaving your bubble can be something as simple as living in South Georgia and traveling to Atlanta.
Yes,
the new world.
Absolutely.
Yes, and something that I always share with them is the day after my grandmother's funeral, after she passed away, I turned to my uncle, and we have a huge family. I turned to my uncle and I say, you know, I'll see you back in Atlanta, because we were having this funeral in Texas. The next day, I wake up on the drive back to Atlanta, and my dad gets the call that I had several uncles that lived in Atlanta. I have two, and then the rest live in Texas. And I told him, I don't know why, just specifically, I hope to see you back in Atlanta, and I hope to see you soon. And the next day, we get the phone call that he had been deported. You know, the day after his mother's funeral. And it's something that it goes to show that there's just no empathy when it comes to immigration. And, you know, everyone's situation is different, and his situation is extremely different. But it's disheartening to see families torn apart. And I think that there's a lot more that we can do when it comes to this. And, you know, it's a conversation that needs to be had. But with that being said, I actually want to bring up something that you mentioned, even with this situation, which were hysterectomies and, you know, men becoming sterile after the ICE detention centers. But if we could, I'd like to bring that up after a quick message from our sponsors. And we're back. So the thing that I wanted to mention was that you obviously have a long history with Planned Parenthood. And Georgia has a horrible history with both Planned Parenthood and women's rights. So what is your first goal? When representing, you know, the 5th district in Congress, when it comes to, you know, abortion and women's rights issues?
So I am thinking long-term and thinking about the Supreme Court and thinking about how we make sure that, well, and I guess this would be before I even get to Congress, but like, that's why it's critical that we get Donald Trump out of office, because we're going to have the ability to have a Democrat, Joe Biden, nominate a Supreme Court justice, maybe more than one, in this next term of the presidency. And so just thinking about that, and so many of the laws around abortion and reproductive justice rights and health are decided on the local level, that it is these judges that are appointed on the federal bench that serve for lifetime appointments. And so making sure that we have a US Senate in place so that when these judges come up for confirmation, that we have two US senators from Georgia that believe in women's bodily autonomy. So unfortunately, a lot of the things that are brought up on the federal level around abortion rights in Congress on the House side are things that are decided on the state level. And I know that all too well, having worked at Planned Parenthood for 10 years as the VP of policy over Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi, the states that have had some of the strictest abortion bans in the country to be decided, and they all end up being decided in a federal court situation. So looking at how we do the work now, between now and Election Day, to make sure that we have judges, that we have the opportunity to confirm judges, whether it's on the Supreme Court or the federal bench, who believe in women's bodily autonomy and respecting the constitutional right to privacy. So that is what I'll be looking forward to, and making sure that once in office, that we are continuing the advocacy work to let our US senators know during confirmation processes where we stand and what we want them, what type of judges we want them to confirm.
Absolutely. And in terms of reproductive health, I mean, I know Damian knows this. I'm currently pro-life with exceptions for race, rape, incest, and the life of the mother. But I think that I have changed my stance last year simply because of the fact that our adoption centers are not sufficient or are equal enough to hold like the masses of people who can be transported after after as an alternative. I think that to actually adopt a pro-life stance, I would have to see great increases in adoption centers, the number and the quality of adoption centers personally. But I want to talk to you about something that I think a lot of my peers have talked to me about, and that's obviously Planned Parenthood. A lot of people don't understand the actual value of Planned Parenthood, not only in reproductive health, but in health in general. I do want to talk to you about this and kind of give you some perspective. So a lot of my peers have been asking, why shouldn't we defund Planned Parenthood, right? Why shouldn't we defund Planned Parenthood? Because they believe that that's a cause for babies' lives being taken away with abortion and things like these. And they think of it as really something that's evil. So what would you say to people who are skeptical of Planned Parenthood, being on the inside of Planned Parenthood for 10 years, and to our conservative counterparts? Because that's something that's a hot topic today.
No, absolutely, Varun. And I respect your beliefs. And I will always use opportunities to educate people around the issue itself. And right. It is absolutely about not having a system of have and have nots for me. I understand what it's like. I look at the history of our country, and as Black women, we were forced to breed basically so that there was slave labor available. And so I'm never going to agree with someone being forced into a pregnancy that they don't want because of the history of where we come from in our country, where we as Black women did not have bodily autonomy and it was forced upon us. And then especially looking at how this has kind of come over through the years just in the healthcare system. And one of the reasons why I fight for Medicare for All is because I don't believe in a healthcare system where there are have and have nots, those who have the ability to pay and those who don't have the ability to pay and the services that you get. And that's what it comes down to with Planned Parenthood and access to high quality, affordable healthcare that includes the option to have an abortion if you and your doctor have made that decision as a healthcare course for you. And right now in this country, if abortion is not legalized, abortions will still happen, but it will be only for those people who can go to their private doctors and who have the means to travel somewhere else where abortions are legal. But there are people who already are disproportionately impacted by so many other healthcare disparities that will be impacted the most. And we saw what happens in this country when abortions are outlawed, with so many women dying trying to self-abort. And I don't say that to just go back to a time that was, and we often talk about unintended consequences and what could happen, and people hear it as scare tactics and fear tactics around abortion rights. But I had the opportunity almost a year ago, November of last year, to travel to El Salvador. And El Salvador has the strictest abortion rights in the country. There's no exception for incest. There's no exceptions for rape. And every miscarriage is investigated. This isn't like what could happen, but this is what is currently happening. And I traveled with a delegation of five legislators from states that who had enacted abortion restrictions: Georgia, Alabama, Ohio, Florida, and Arizona. And the five of us went, and we were able to actually go to a prison in El Salvador and sit down and talk with women who are serving 30 and 40 year sentences in prison for having miscarriages, because there's no way to determine if it was a miscarriage or a spontaneous abortion, which is the medical term, or if someone, or if it was a self-induced abortion. And that's not where we need to go in this country, where women who had much wanted pregnancies are serving 40-year sentences in prison because they suffered a miscarriage. So we need to look at the real faces behind the unintended consequences that we talk about. And I would love to share with you the docu-short that CBS News did around our delegation trip to El Salvador, just so that you can hear some of these women's stories, so that when you think about the things that could happen in this country if we outlaw abortion and what that means for doctors who are then criminalized for just giving women life-saving care. We went to a hospital a national hospital, like the state hospital in El Salvador, and doctors saying that they had to watch women just die in the emergency room, because if they tried to save them, they could be accused of helping them and aiding them in having an abortion. And so doctors whose hands are tied at doing their job of saving lives because of abortion restrictions. So that is what I would share with them, and absolutely hope that they can see the humanity in giving women bodily autonomy and not investigating women at some of the most vulnerable and emotional times of their life.
Yeah, it's extremely heartbreaking. And some of these things that you're hearing, it's like, oh, that would never happen here. And I feel like that's been the conversation that's always being had. Oh, that'll never happen here. That can't happen here. You know, you're talking about what's happening with Muslims in China, with basically what are concentration camps. You think, oh, that can't happen here. And then you look at something similar, which is the ICE detainment centers and at the border with the zero tolerance policy. And you're like, yeah, that's completely different. It's just such a weird perception that we have here as Americans, that we think that we can do no wrong. And I think that a big step in moving forward is doing that wrong, but acknowledging it, or at least acknowledging the fact that we have, you know, committed grievances upon other people in the past. Something huge here that Politatine is working at is trying to find a way that in our community we can acknowledge those grievances. And before we came on the podcast, I got a notification on Twitter saying that an elementary school here in the county was going to be named New Hope after one of the first I think it was still during segregation, all African-American elementary
and
schools.
We live in Forsyth County, by the way.
Yes. So, you know, it's this idea that recognition is so crucial to so many Americans. What do you think is the biggest step? Because right now there's three, or, you know, I'd say three. I'd argue that they're intertangled ideas here in the United States. It's the race, you know, the division between race. Some might call it a race war, whatever you want to label it as. It's the racial tensions going throughout the nation. There's the COVID-19 pandemic, and there's, you know, the economic crisis. What can we do to resolve, firstly, those racial tensions, or at least ease them?
So I think having conversations like this, where we are at least acknowledging that they exist, there are still too many people in our country that don't even want to acknowledge that there are racial tensions. President. The number of times that I've heard people say, but we had a Black president, so we are living in a post-racial society, and people that truly believe that. So that's part of it, is acknowledging the, like, how far we've come, but how far we still have left to go. I think the other piece is just looking at, if you look at, and you can take the COVID-19 pandemic as an example, and the way that it has shined a spotlight on so many inequities throughout our country, on our education system, on infrastructure in this country, on the economy, on, I mean, just so many different things, healthcare, that COVID-19 itself has shined a spotlight on. And having a national response to this pandemic can help us in so many ways. Like, my son Carter just started virtual kindergarten, and I'm thinking about how my husband and I are both working from home, but there are so many people out there that I know, even parents in his school, they're not able to work from home because their jobs demand that they work outside of the home.
Right.
And so we are very privileged that we are able to work from home and be here with him. But what is happening to those other students? And then so that impacts their education for generations to come, because we know that early childhood education is key. Or looking in rural areas, where my sister, who lives in Alabama, and I have my two nieces who are also in virtual school right now, but they don't have broadband access in the neighborhood that she lives in Alabama. And so, because they did not run the wires, so the infrastructure just isn't there. So how is that impacting people? Or then looking at the economy, I currently work for the National Domestic Workers Alliance. And I know that domestic workers have been impacted by this more so than others, because domestic workers work inside of people's homes. And so when everything shut down, and you are not going out, you're certainly not letting people come into your homes. Or if you are, they're being put at risk. Or looking at the impacts of COVID-19 and how at one point during the pandemic, 80% of the hospitalizations in Georgia were Black people. And my zip code was number one for infections at one point. And looking at how that impacts us. And why is it that more Black people are being infected? And it's because of other pre-existing health conditions that like high blood pressure because of stressors in society, which can also be linked back to systemic racism and oppression. And so just looking at, I mean, I think the COVID-19 pandemic is a great way to look at so many other issues through an intersectional lens and how we are all connected and how this one thing can impact so many other different issues and how we move forward in our country.
Yeah. Yeah. And the very interesting thing is that the people who are playing down the pandemic are the people who aren't necessarily affected by it as much as those minorities who are working the essential worker professions that you talked about earlier. I do want to mention the idea that you mentioned of Obama, of President Obama and of hope, because I can't say when Obama got elected that I never thought to myself, well, this is the end of discrimination, of real American discrimination. But looking into it more, especially in 2016, we saw it. The rise of Obama, the Obama administration, did not mean the end of racism. And that's something that I have to reiterate to a lot of people, because we saw the exact opposite unfold in 2016. Donald Trump is really the embodiment of tensions and I would say a backlash towards the election of a Black president in America. And I think that there's a lot that goes towards saying that says that more so Black Americans aren't given the same opportunities as white Americans and non-minority people in our nation today. And with the NDWA, National Domestic Workers Alliance, I saw one of the movements that they had was the strike for Black lives. And that was something that really inspired me because I've been a constant advocate for better working conditions, better professions for African Americans and minorities. I think that the biggest contributing factor, in my opinion, to high unemployment rates and not a lot of job opportunities for African Americans is incarceration in our nation. I believe that our system of incarceration has to be fixed for our next generation of people, simply because we focus upon the incarceration of African Americans and minorities for nonviolent crimes. And that really does disenfranchise people, for example, lead to lower job opportunities, lead to less work benefits and greater job instability. It's really a benefactor to a lot of these issues that the NDWA is fighting against. And I think that we have to focus more, Nakema, on rehab as opposed to arresting people for nonviolent drug arrests and drug crimes like that, because the war on drugs has been nothing but discriminatory and nothing but diminutive on the Black community, on minorities from across our nation. So what is your stance? I asked Fani Willis, our current Fulton County DA, about this a couple of weeks ago, but what is your stance on how we can fix our incarceration system to really help minority communities advance their cause and advance job opportunities for them? And what do you think is the correlation between the war on drugs and lowered opportunities for Black Americans in our nation?
I mean, I think there's actually a direct correlation. And if you look at just the unequal sentencing that we saw coming through the 90s between powder cocaine and crack cocaine, and the way that it was, these laws were applied to different communities and the sentencings that were applied. And then you look at right now, people who still have marijuana convictions on their records, when there are some states in this country where recreational use of marijuana is legal, and other states you are still, some people are still serving time. We've got to get that right. So I think one step in the right direction is a federal bill to make recreational marijuana usage legal. And then we need to expunge the records of anyone who had convictions, and making sure that we also in the process have a system that allows people of color in this country who've been disproportionately impacted to get into the system where people are actually making money off of the growing and the selling and the dispensaries around recreational and medicinal marijuana usage. So I think there are some things that we absolutely can do on the federal level, working along with our local leaders and local law enforcement to get this right. But I think that is one of the, a huge step in the right direction if we can get the recreational marijuana use, all of the people who are currently serving time, get these records, get their sentences commuted and get their records expunged.
I think that it's absolutely crucial. And I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned, and this is something that, that caught my eye, or that you mentioned earlier that I had paid attention to, it was the healthcare system. And you brought it a little bit later with the COVID-19 pandemic and saying that the disparity in the healthcare system was shown. But what can we do moving forward to make sure that that healthcare system is fixed? And how much of it, because I think that a lot of people still misunderstand so many different concepts, whether you're talking about the simplest of concepts, Black Lives Matter, you know, more controversial ones like ACAB or defunding the police. But even the word oppression, I think, has been misunderstood. And I wanted to know your take on this more specifically. But I was watching a video a couple days ago where this young girl was explaining why women aren't oppressed today. And she said that we can, that women can vote now, and that there's been studies that show that the wage gap isn't really affecting women, and she brought different points. But simply the fact that women couldn't vote 100 years ago, I think, is enough to be inclined to believe that oppression happened. And what I mean by that is, when you take people, and this is, I think it's the exact same thing when you're talking about oppression for the African-American community, but, or, you know, any minority community, but when you take people out of positions of power and you let another group of people go into those positions of power for generations and generations and generations, and then all of a sudden you want this, you know, you pass Brown v. the Board of Education, and there's all these groups trying to come back together, you have the gentrification, you have the separation, and now it may not be because of wealth, but it's, or it may not be because of race, but because of wealth from those, you know, racially driven, racially motivated segregatory bills. So what does oppression mean in today's America? And what does oppression mean? And what does the fight for women's right look like moving forward?
So as times change, the way that oppression looks changes and is not like your textbook definition of what you might remember from like the history of like the 60s and before. And just like, so one form of oppression is when, as we talked about voter suppression and seeing the long lines that are predominantly in communities of color, that is a form of oppression by making it harder for us to have our voices heard in the political process. What we see moving forward in who our elected officials are and us being able to be seen in the political process, representation absolutely matters. And when I hear from young Black girls that they're excited to hear from me because they had not had an opportunity to talk to a senator that looks like them, there are segments of our population that never had to worry about someone representing them in our government. Those are forms of oppression that don't look the same as they looked like. It is not the same as telling me that I have to go through the back door of a building, but making sure that our voices are not heard at the ballot box and making sure that people that look like me are in elective office in this country in the highest of political seats. And now we have someone like Kamala Harris running for Vice President of the United States of America is a huge shift in the right direction. So I think just looking at the like changes that still remind us that we operate in systems that were not designed by us or for people that look like us. And so there, we still have a ways to go in making sure that we have true representation for all of us in this country.
Right, absolutely. I mean, there's a certain beauty to having people who look like you running for office. For example, seeing Kamala Harris, my sister, was like, that's an Indian, Varun, running for office, running for the office of vice president. That's an Indian. And I was like, yeah, she is. She's an Indian American. And it was incredible because there was a certain beauty to having her running for office as both a black senator and an Indian American and a woman. So a lot of different things coming on with Kamala Harris. But I think that on Damian's point, that fighting for equality is not something that stops with one improvement. It's a constant pursuit for equality. And I think that the main issue in terms of healthcare is that disproportionately, again, minorities don't get access to healthcare and right insurance. And that's why Medicaid is so important. And one of the biggest things, Nikema, that I've been advocating for is that we argue solutions instead of arguing about the facts. And with Medicaid, it's more important than ever because the Republicans, they talk about how Medicaid is a bad bill, a flawed bill, and a flawed piece of legislation, and they never provide an alternative. And that's something I've always seen. They always reference some kind of bill that they have in the works, but they've never once mentioned the actual tenets of that bill. And that's something that I think that we have to fix in our nation. It's we talked about it with the state running for state senator. His name is William Hughes, our state representative. He talked to us about the fact that it's really important in this nation to stop disputing the facts and start disputing the actual solutions. Now, one thing I wanted to ask you about on that topic is climate change, because as a teen, as a young kid, and as a 16-year-old, I'm very concerned about the state of this environment going forward because of how much we're doing to hinder our environment, deteriorate our environment. We saw that last week, I believe, in San Francisco, going on today, the fires that really are ravaging our nation. So what do you think is the path towards creating a more equitable climate future and creating coalition between our nation, not only our nation, but other nations in the world that can kind of come together and say, this has to stop. And we have to really, really support our environment, because we saw Scientific American for the first time made an endorsement of a candidate. And that was Joe Biden, because they believe that the issues in our nation are too prevalent with the climate for us to take a backseat and to not support the people that want to fight for climate equity. So what do you think is the solution? Is it, you know, for example, a carbon tax, or what is the solution in Congress for us to move forward here?
So I think another one of those things that we talked about earlier, where like the politics of it shuts people off from the beginning and thinking about things that are a part of the Green New Deal. Right. And I support the Green New Deal, and people seem shocked when I tell them that, because I guess they don't, I don't know why they're shocked, but for some reason. But if you look at like the individual policies that encompass the Green New Deal, like, it is exactly the direction that we need to be going in this country. Are Absolutely. We going to get it all at once? Probably not, but we have to be bold and ambitious. And for far too long, we've been making these incremental changes that really haven't gotten us to where we need to be to protect our environment, to protect our planet, to protect us for generations to come. And like, there are things like infrastructure needs and making sure that we are addressing lead in our pipes and addressing nuclear power and addressing offshore, so many things that need to be addressed in this country. And until someone is ready to move forward on a bold agenda and stand up for what we know is right, we're gonna continue to have people that are not willing to even address the science of the issue. Right now, we have far too many people that don't even believe in the science of climate change, let alone policies that are gonna get us to addressing it. So I am thrilled at the number of people that are going to federal office that actually, number one, it seems like a very low bar, but believe in science, believe in experts and the data that goes along with it. So we have a long way to go, but yeah. I am so very hopeful by this new class of people coming into Congress, by us having Joe Biden and Kamala Harris leading us at the top of the ticket, and what we'll be able to get done when I get to Congress and representing the people of the 5th Congressional District.
Yes, 1,000%. And I think that, you know, you say some people that don't believe in science. We saw the president's remarks towards climate change when he was meeting with, I believe it was the governor of San Francisco, and it was just ridiculous. And you had the town hall last night, but nonetheless, I think that seeing these people and seeing you, you know, as a potential congresswoman gives so many people hope. And I think that hope is something that we need right now. So I want to ask you one final question, and that is, if you had one saying, message, thing, or quote that you would like to leave to America's youth, what would it be?
I would say live your life out loud and on purpose. We need more people willing to speak up and speak out for what they know is just, fair, and right. And if you are purposeful in your decision-making and you're willing to live those values out loud, then we can make the change that we need in this country to move all of us forward to achieving the full promise of America.
Love those values out loud.
Yep.
A quote to live by from Senator Nkema Williams and a future congresswoman in the works, but we loved having you on today, Senator. A great conversation and many more to come. I would love to see you represent us on the national stage, and I'm looking forward to that day where I can call you our congresswoman.
Thank you so much.
And ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for tuning into today's episode. Thank you, Varun, for being an amazing co-host as always. And be sure to tune in to our next episode, which will be coming out this Monday. Thank you.
Hello, 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 everybody. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Politician Podcast. If you enjoyed our conversation, head on over to www.patreon.com/Politician Podcast for more exclusive members-only content, special episodes, and merch drops. That is, once again, www.patreon.com/Politician Podcast. I'm going to make it a jingle when I grow up. It is www.patreon.com/Politician Podcast. No, I'm just kidding, you guys. But definitely visit www.politicianpodcast.com. For more amazing content from myself, Damien, our team, our amazing artwork head, and our sponsors over at Politician. And once again, thank you so much for watching today's episode. Thank you to my co-host, Damien Galvin, for an amazing conversation, my friend. I do appreciate your input, as always. And that said, have a great rest of your weekend. Chime in for the next episode, and we hope you enjoyed today's conversation.